Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, I'm Tara Gatewood. Each month, we turn to the pages of new books to learn what Native authors have to say. This October, we are opening up our electronic talking circle to another book that's giving more insight into Native Hawaii. The October Book of the Month is titled A Nation Rising. It's a collection of voices that are speaking of the struggles Native Hawaiians have stood against and the type of resiliency that has kept their nation alive. We're inviting you to join us as we put the book spotlight on A Nation Rising, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native organizations are among those releasing statements on the recent school shooting in Washington state, including the National Indian Education Association and the National Congress of American Indians. The NCAI Executive Board says they're deeply saddened by the tragedy at Marysville Pilchuck High School and say their thoughts and prayers are with the families of the victims, the students, and the Tulalip tribes. NCAI goes on to say it's at times like these that Native communities from across the country come together in support of each other. Media reports say the shooter, Jalen Freiberg, was from a prominent Tulalip family. He reportedly opened fire at a high school, killing one person and injuring four others, including his cousins, before taking his own life. NCAI President Brian Cladisby, a well-known leader in the Pacific Northwest, expressed his solidarity with the Tulalip tribes. Services were held for Native American actress Misty Upham over the weekend. Her family had reported her missing earlier this month. Her body was later found in Auburn. She appeared in many television and movie roles, including 2013's August Osage County. She's being remembered by many Native Americans in the film industry. Actor, comedian, and motivational speaker Tatanka Mean says she was an inspiration.
I looked at her as an inspiration because not only was she just a great actress, but she wasn't doing Westerns. I mean, she wasn't doing these period pieces. She was looking for one type of work, I think, and that was, you know, mainstream work, and that was what she went after. She was a serious actress. It wasn't, you know, a hobby. It wasn't just when, an audition came in and she sent in something. I think she really studied the art and took it really seriously, and you can tell because of these major roles that she played. And, you know, she's an inspiration to not just me, but, you know, young kids that are out there that want to excel in the entertainment industry and the film industry and the on theater, on stage. Much love to all of her family out there, all of her friends, and the community of Misty Upham.
Her family is voicing concerns about how police have handled her case. A family press release claims wrongdoing, which police have publicly disputed. Over the weekend, a British Columbia First Nation marked 150 years since its war chiefs were wrongfully executed. As Lisa Hale reports, the provincial government has apologized and cleared their names.
In the 1860s, British settlers tried to build a road to the Cariboo goldfields right through Silcoteen territory. The nation had been decimated by smallpox, and the road was seen as a path for more disease. The nation fought back, and the colony responded with military force, touching off the Chilcotin War. Authorities invited the Silcoteen to peace talks, but instead their war chiefs were arrested, tried, and hanged on October 26, 1864. Before his execution, Chief Kletsasin declared that the Silcoteen had meant war, not murder. The road was never completed. In June of this year, the Supreme Court of Canada affirmed Silcoteen ownership of its territory for the first time in the country's history. Chief Roger William credits the war chiefs for the win.
Our people really feel that the sacrifice of those warriors, the warrior leaders, are the reason why we won Aboriginal title.
Last week, the provincial government exonerated the Tsilhqot'in chiefs and apologized to the nation for their wrongful execution 150 years ago.
It's a good start. We call it a good start. And I think there needs to be more work, and it's not over yet.
For National Native News, I'm Lisa Hale in Vancouver.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu.
National Native News brings you information from around Indian Country and the world. Find out how to reach our listeners while also supporting this program by visiting nativenews.net.
Built by Native business for Native business, the Native American Contractors Association B2B Conference and Expo, November 10th to 12th. Participants engage in discussion, build contacts, get federal contracting training, and business development. Registration at nativecontractors.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. The indigenous voice in Hawaii has never been silenced. Native Hawaii has seen many changes in their homeland, and over the decades, Kanaka Maoli, or Native Hawaiians, have faced many challenges to keep their cultural and political ways of life strong so that the next generation can thrive. A new book, A Nation Rising, Hawaiian Movements for Life, Land, and Sovereignty, brings many indigenous voices together to recount important parts of their history, including a close look at social movements that have brought about change and more truth to the forefront. And the book also puts the spotlight on many of the people that have inspired the movements. And today we are inviting you to join us for the October Book of the Month. And as you learn more about this part of the indigenous planet and call in to share your thoughts or ask questions, you'll get an extra bonus with your call. We're giving away 10 copies of the book to the first 10 callers to make it on air this hour, courtesy of Duke Press. And the number to connect to us and the book, A Nation Rising, is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go ahead and bring in our first guest. On the line from her home in Manoa, Hawaii, is Kanaka Maoli educator and author Noilani Goodyear Kaiopua, and she is an associate professor of political science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And she is one of the editors for the book we're spotlighting today. And she's also the author of the book, The Seeds We Planted, Portraits of a Native American, Native Hawaiian Charter School. I want to go ahead and welcome Noilani to our hour. Welcome, Noilani.
Aloha, Tara, and thank you for having me, and aloha to all the listeners out there.
Well, Noilani, it's great to be connecting with you, and I just want to applaud, you know, all of the folks who contributed to this book. There is so much rich information, especially a part of the history about Native Hawaii that I'm sure not a lot of people, you know, experience every day or when they hear about Native Hawaiians. And so I'm really excited to be sharing this with our audience. And is there anything you just want to start off with, you know, about the book that you think people are going to connect to?
Yes. You know, I think that the book, like you said, gathers together so many different kinds of voices, people of different generations, people who are scholars, people who are activists, people who are journalists, filmmakers, that really tell a story about aloha aina, which is our word for love for the land, but also our word for love for our country and patriotism. It's the word that our ancestors of the 19th century used to describe their resistance against U.S. Colonialism and U.S. imperialism. And so the stories that are told here are sort of the 20th and 21st century versions of that, of resistance that's motivated by deep love and care for the place that we call home, Hawaii.
And Noilani, the title of the book is A Nation Rising, Hawaiian Movements for Life, Land, and Sovereignty. I also understand that there was a working title that you feel really, you know, describes the essence of what this book is really about. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. The original title of the book was Ea, and Ea is another word in our language that we use to describe several things, life, breath, sovereignty, emergence, or to be rising, like the way a whale comes to the top of the surface of the ocean, that would be ea. So it's a word that that our kupuna of the 19th century, again, chose to describe state sovereignty, you know, having a state, a country. And I believe that they really chose that because we see sovereignty as an active state of being, that it needs to be done day after day. It needs to be a practice. You know, it's not something that you have, that you possess, but it's really something that you do. And so when back in the 1900s, the 19th century, when U.S. annexation was a threat that it was on the table, James Kauli'a, one of the Aloha Aina, the patriots of that time, said that annexation would be like being buried alive, like not being able to breathe. And so that idea of ea is that our life is dependent upon us having sovereignty.
And, you know, reading the book and just, you know, making parallels, I guess, to my knowledge of Native America, you all have put together, you know, a very broad range of movements here in the book. It's almost like talking about, you know, the genesis of the National Congress of American Indians, the American Indian Movement, as well as the Alaska Federation of Natives, and putting all of the major moments that people, you know, step forward and put into one book, and seeing that, you know, coming from a Native Hawaiian perspective. Noe, what are you hoping will change when it comes to people's perceptions of indigenous nations from Hawaii?
Well, one of the things that, you know, we lead off in talking with the book, talking about in the book, is the way that these movements have certainly created gains for Hawaiian people. For example, the establishment of Hawaiian language schools from the preschool level all the way up to graduate school. But there are also gains that have been felt that serve everyone. So one of the stories that's told is the fight for water, for taro farming. And so that fight has really helped to protect water as a public trust resource that is available to all people in Hawaii. So one of the things that we hope for non-Hawaiians or non-Indigenous people who are reading the book is that they can see this isn't necessarily an us-them struggle. It's really a struggle for justice. It's a struggle for protecting the land and the resources here and protecting our collective identity as Kanaka Maoli, that we want to, as Native Hawaiians, be able to continue recognizing and honoring our unique connections with each other and with this place.
And, you know, we're going to continue hearing more about what's in the book, but I also want to remind you that if you are interested in what you're hearing, you can call in. If you got questions, call in with those too. Or if there are thoughts you want to share, you can. All you have to do is call us at 1-800-99-NATIVE, and our first 10 callers to make it on air will receive a copy of the book. So you can beef up on your winter reading by calling in 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go ahead and go to the phone lines. We have Gregory in Anchorage, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Gregory, what are you wondering?
Oh, thank you. I was listening and interested in reading the book because I was wondering how the Hawaiian people have thrived so well and without the seeming land base that many of the indigenous people in America have been fighting for. And there, I guess Hawaiians are still fighting for, but if there's any indication of how any land base might be received as a result of the work that's being done.
All right, Gregory. Noelani, what can you say about, you know, what Gregory's interested in being in the book?
That's a great question. One of the things that we try to chart in the book is a number of different land struggles. So, like Gregory mentioned, you know, we do not have, as Native Hawaiians, a land base that we collectively have power over. at the present time. And one of the major catalysts of the Hawaiian movement was the land struggles that started really taking place in the 1970s, because after Hawaii became a state of the U.S., there was a rush of U.S. settlers, and so a lot of development happened and people being pushed off of their lands at that time. So there are several different land struggles that we try to document in the book. And really that was a major force behind people beginning to realize, what is the problem here? Why are we being pushed off these lands? Who do these lands actually legitimately belong to? As far as today, you know, the struggle continues over our lands and what happens on them. One of the ongoing struggles, for example, there's a portrait piece in the book about Mauna Awa Kea. It's also known as Mauna Kea. It's the highest mountain in our islands, and it's being slated for the construction of the largest telescope in the world that would be several football fields large, and it would be the biggest building on the entire island. And that's something that just recently Kanaka on that island, on Hawaii Island, engaged in a blockade over the groundbreaking ceremony for that telescope. So these land struggles are ongoing, you know, continuing on to this very day.
All right. Thank you for that. And Gregory, also thank you for your call. We hope you enjoy the book. And, you know, is this a new part of Hawaiian history that you're hearing today? Do you want to hear more? Give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. I'm going to go ahead and bring in another voice into the hour. Also at his home today in Manoa, Hawaii, is Kanaka Maoli journalist Ikaika Hosi, and he is the founder and publisher of the award-winning current affairs news magazine, Hawaii Independent. And Ikaika has also been a community organizer and advocate for Hawaiian independence for 15 years, and he is also one of the book's editors. The book title is A Nation Rising, and it is our October Book of the Month. You will receive a copy. First 10 callers to call in and make it on air. 1-800-996-2848. And let's go ahead and bring in Ikaika. Hello, Ikaika. Welcome to the hour.
Good morning. Thanks very much.
And Ikaika, Noelani has given us, you know, a view into the book, but what would you like to start us off with? You know, what does this book mean to you?
For me, I'm very interested in how we can rethink how we've come to the present. You know, there were attempts over the last 40 or 50 years to overdevelop our islands and to dramatically change our way of life. And if not for certain individuals and community groups, community leaders, our islands would be much worse off. And so I'm really interested in telling the stories of resistance and inspiring people now, young people today, to realize that there's a real potency to their action, to folks who are willing to fight and to resist.
And Ikaika, you know, were there any sections of the book that maybe even now you find yourself turning to more and more as you see the wealth that's in your hands?
You know, it's a particular section. What I'm really inspired by is the diversity of voices. The fact that so many people in so many walks of life across the islands have stood up and have committed themselves to trying to make their community better. And something that I think might be particularly interesting for your listenership, Farah, is that there is a lot of cross-pollination between the indigenous movements in Hawaii and the indigenous movements in North America. There were a lot of our leaders who would get involved in struggles in Native America and would bring some of that knowledge and some of that consciousness back home and would then in turn inspire changes within our own community. And one particular example of that is between the folks who stopped the bombing of our island, Koho'olawe. they would stay in touch with the people in Vieques in Puerto Rico who were trying to do the same thing. And they would coordinate, you know, they would learn from each other. And I think that they were helping to inspire each other to eventually be very successful.
And we learn a lot. You know, I think something that I kept going back to it as I was reading about different moments in, you know, social movements there in Hawaii is just kind of how a lot of it turns back to culture. And I want to hear what you folks think about, you know, culture also being the root of social movements. I also want to remind our listening audience today, we have invited two Native educators and authors, also a journalist, and they are a part of many voices in the book called A Nation Rising that focuses in on Hawaiian movements and also sovereignty. And if there are questions you'd like to ask, you can call us 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And when you think of your own community, you know, what can be learned by studying the social movements of our tribal nations? Call us right now. We want to hear what you think. 1-800-996-2848. And let's go ahead and hear more from our callers. We have Travis on the line in Grand Falls, Arizona, tuned in on KUYI. Travis, what would you like to add?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just like the comment, like we need more Native authors writing about more, you know, especially pertaining to Native subjects instead of like non-Natives, you know, especially if they're, you know, writing history or something. So, and just like to mention, one of my favorite authors, I don't know if they heard, is James Welch. And that's all. I guess that's it. Thank you.
All right. Travis, thank you for your call there in Grand Falls. Let's go ahead and take another caller. We got Lynn in Gallup, New Mexico, tuned in on KGLP. Lynn, what would you like to add?
Good morning. I have a question. Thank you to your guests for writing about the Native Hawaiian perspectives. I have a question about how the people there see their cultural connections with Native Americans in the United States, since culturally they're more part of Polynesia and the rest of the ocean island cultures, and yet for federal purposes they end up under the United States umbrella. So how do people now see the connection? Do they feel connected with Native America in the States, or do they feel more culturally connected with the other island cultures, and how does that affect their politics and so on?
All right, Lynn, thank you for your question. Again, you can join us too, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE, and it is our October Book of the Month. Ikaika, what do you think?
I think that's a really great question. The caller is correct. Hawaii is part of Polynesia, and our roots go back, you know, thousands of years in the Pacific. But I think we feel an incredible amount of solidarity with Native North America, with Native Americans, and we're very, very much inspired by the resilience and resistance of all of your peoples. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks for that, Lynn. Thank you for your call. We're going to bring in another. We have Jennifer in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Jennifer, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the show. I'm just excited because I've never been to Hawaii. It's really tiresome what Hollywood and the media has always fed us about what Hawaii is, that's not the truth. And I'm excited that there is more movement and more momentum afoot from the indigenous people of Hawaii. And I want to know what Hawaii always really was. So, it's exciting and it's educational, and this is the real thing.
All right, Jennifer, thank you for your call. And we know you're going to enjoy the book, too. Noelani, anything you want to add? Jennifer brought up a great point about, you know, how the rest of the world sees Hawaii. You know, how does this play into setting things straight?
Sure. I teach, young adults at the university, and we get a lot of folks who are from here in Hawaii and from afar, that are very much impacted by just media representations of the island. And I think that those tend to, you know, really erase the deep genealogical and cultural connections that Kanaka Maoli, we as natives, have to the land, to the place here. And so one of the things that this book really tries to do is to talk about what those deep connections have meant to people and what they've motivated people to do. So Ikaika mentioned the Kaho'olawe struggle, and, you know, one of the stories that Walter Riddy, who was one of the first people who landed on the island in the late 1970s to stop the U.S. military bombing of the island, he said that when he was being taken off the island in this helicopter, and the helicopter was rising up from the island, that he looked down at it, and as the island became smaller and smaller, he said that he felt the land really speaking to him, that it was saying, you know, I'm being killed here. And from our perspective, culturally, this is our mother, right? Our like for many indigenous people. So he felt that he and others were motivated to put their own lives on the line, put their bodies between the land and the bombs that were being dropped, and to say, you know, we're not going to let our island be killed. So that's, you know, those kinds of things definitely don't get represented in the media. I also wanted to just make one comment in relation to the previous caller, Lynn's comment about cultural connections to Native America. We've had some really great connections with indigenous peoples from the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, our ancestors, when whaling became an important industry in the world in the late 1820s, went off and were traveling on whaling ships, and some of them actually settled in the Pacific Northwest. So there have been times when I've been to different places, particularly in the Vancouver area, where we'll meet people who are have had Kanaka Maoli come into their own genealogies, into their indigenous genealogies, you know, a couple hundred years ago, and became integrated. So there are those connections as well.
And, you know, we're making a lot of connections today here, too. We're about to go to break. And, you know, just hearing, you know, folks and the type of questions that are coming forward, I'm wondering, you know, from our two authors, you know, how much more bridging do you think needs to happen so that we can understand, especially when it comes to social movements? And if you think, you know, combining, you know, helps both sides. We're going to go to break here. You can also ask your questions, wonder out loud with us by calling in 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're going to be right back after this short break, but our phone lines will remain open, so you can still continue to join the conversation. Post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is often associated with military veterans, but anyone who experiences trauma can get PTSD. On the next Native America Calling, join me, Tara Gatewood, as we discuss what PTSD looks like in Native America and what kind of treatments are available.
Buju, gikamamui minuayam in gishbin ganoin dagusien. Maji dangi gwenenegame gushke denogizisung medaswe ashinano gunagazid. Nandige kendan gishbin da debain dagusien. Mawadishuin www.healthcare.gov/tribal. Gamaganoj 1-800-318-2596. Jidaji kaman. Kaundinagadig the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Miigwech.
Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Misleta Pueblo, and today we are featuring the book, A Nation Rising, Hawaiian Movements for Life, Land, and Sovereignty. And we're learning more about Native Hawaii and the social movements that have given way to more strength to Native Hawaiians. And we'd also like you to add your thoughts to the conversation. If you have a question about what you're hearing today, you can call in. And we are at 1-800-996-2848. And if you are one of the first 10 callers to make it on air with a comment or question, you'll receive a complimentary copy of the book courtesy of Duke Press. And the number to dial in is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And on the line from Hawaii today are the book's editors. We have No'ilani Goodyear Kaupua and also Ikaika Hosi. And they are both on the line with us. I want to welcome both of them back. And No'ilani, before the break, you know, just thinking out loud about how, bridging understanding, especially when it comes to social movements, you know, does that help, you know, Indigenous nations either together or maybe back at home? What do you think, No'ilani?
Definitely those connections, sharing ideas, sharing strategies helps. One of the last articles in the book is about our fight against biocolonialism by big biotech companies who are creating genetically modified organisms and field testing them in our homeland. Typically, it's corn that's being tested and GMO seed that's being developed here also requires a tremendous amount of pesticide that is being dumped on our lands, poisoning our waters, poisoning our children. Many of these fields where it's happening is right across the street from elementary schools, for example, or elderly care homes. And we've had already, great connections with people in various Native American nations that are similarly fighting the genetic modification, for example, of wild rice and also corn, again, considering corn an ancestor. So those connections are really important. We also really learn a lot from the kinds of actions that are being taking place. For example, blockades that have been happening to stop major pipelines from going through Native territories and, again, poisoning water supplies and Native lands. So all those are really important as far as for us. We all are not only subject to U.S. empire, but also the increasing power of multinational corporations that are able to influence the political systems. And so it's really important for us to have those connections because these entities are not in a single place, but they're in many, many places.
All right. Thanks for that. No'ilani, we got another caller we're bringing in. Again, you can join us. It is our October Book of the Month. We're giving away some of the books. It looks like we got 6 books left, so there are plenty. Give us a call and join the discussion. 1-800-996-2848. Let's go ahead and bring in Simeon, who is driving in New Mexico, tuned in on KUNN. And I understand you got a question for us. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. This is a great program. I was wondering if your guests could maybe comment a bit on the struggle in Hawaii over water rights for traditional farming. I think one of them mentioned it before, taro farming. And also the case over the Waiholi Ditch, I believe it's called, that was very very notable, I guess, maybe about a decade ago in the Hawaii Supreme Court, which I think held that the public trust in Hawaii requires protection of the right to use water for that traditional native farming practices. So I wonder if they could just comment on where that struggle or effort stands now and some of its history.
Okay, thanks for your call. Again, join the conversation, 1-800-99-NATIVE. Ikaika, go ahead.
Okay, so the thanks for the question about water rights. If I could put that into some context, the development of the modern economy in Hawaii has been basically a story about the taking of water from native economies, from the native indigenous economy, and moving that into and taking it from that and moving it into a monocrop plantation economy. And so when water is taken, then land becomes unfarmable, and entire communities were basically decimated because they weren't able to sustain themselves economically, and which created a loss of land and then became the means for enriching a small group of plantation industrial agriculturalists. And some of those companies have then become global companies, like Dole Plantation, for instance. It's now a global producer of food products, but it actually started in Hawaii, and it started with its roots in the creation of the monocrop industry in Hawaii. So it's a very old problem, and it has ramifications both in terms of specific native planting practices like kala production, but it also ties into the entire history of dispossession and loss of sovereignty in Hawaii. The Waiholi case is particularly important and inspiring. It was fought over several generations by taro farmers on the windward side of Oahu. And the author that wrote in our book about this fight, she actually sort of inherited it from her mother-in-law and her parents-in-law who had been fighting for before her. And the victory that they were able to win in our Supreme Court is really important because it enshrines indigenous economic production as a trigger that basically forces the water rights to be given to native farmers. And so it's a really wonderful thing. What's also really cool about it is that it says that that the basis for everyone's use of water, like in Hawaii, water is a public good, and things like access to the beaches are all protected for the entire public. But it's protected for the public because of ancient traditional rights over access to those resources, and so. I'm really proud of the fact that it's basically enshrining indigenous practice at the center of modern law. So I think that's really cool. I'm wondering what Noe thinks about it.
All right. Noe, hold that. I got a caller we want to bring in. We're bringing in Jim, driving in Bend, Oregon, tuned in to us today. And Jim, what would you like to add?
You know, it's really interesting. I heard your radio program coming out of the mountains in Oregon, and I'm actually from Arizona, and I'm a hotshot driver. I go all over the country. So I've seen strip coal mining in Wyoming. I've seen groundwater resources depleted in Kansas. We've been here as a species less than 200,000 years, and we are dramatically affecting the future of the planet that we all live on. And this goes beyond a Native American issue. And it's interesting how the people that speak up for the land are the same people that spoke up to the land 200 and some years ago when the Europeans came to the United States. And it started with the fur trade, and now it's with coal, oil, and water. And if we don't listen to the Native Americans, the stewards of the lands in all the countries all over the world, we're not going to have any resources left, and we will not be able to survive. So I thank you for the program. I thank you for the guests today. And this is a global issue. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
All right, Jim, thank you for your call. There in Oregon, let's bring in another. We got Laura in South Dakota traveling. Laura, what would you like to add?
I was just wondering, earlier in the program, they had talked about the land and how they were just pushed aside, and I was just wondering what actually did happen to that. Were they able to keep their homes? Did the land just get taken away from them?
Okay. Laura, thank you for your call. No, Ilani, I know that's a big answer. Go ahead. And you know, put it in perspective.
Sure. Let me address that question, and then I'll go back to Jim's question. Essentially, what happened to our land is there's roughly 4 million acres in Hawaii. About half of that at the time of the U.S. takeover was controlled by the government. It was government and crown lands. And so what the essentially what happened is the U.S. Seized those lands through the 1898 New Lands Resolution. And so the rest of the lands, have been used for various private purposes. But those lands, a lot of them were put into military usage. A lot of the things that the state and the U.S. Federal government control in Hawaii now are on those stolen lands. So the sovereignty movement really has been about reclaiming those lands as, you know, the collective legacy of our kingdom that should still belong to Hawaiians. So that's sort of the land question. And then I think it really connects very well to Jim's point about how, you know, everyone is being impacted by an incredibly exploitative, mass consumption based economy and style of living. And like Ikaika was mentioning, you know, we saw that transition here from our traditional agricultural forms to monocrop cash-based agricultural industry. And so it's those kinds of practices that really need to be changed. And there's a huge urgency for that change to take place because, as Jim mentioned, we're really facing, when you think about climate change and all of the different kinds of really damaging extraction that are taking place from our islands, from, you know, your lands on the North American continent, we need to really shift the whole way that we are living and relating to, you know, that mainstream society is living and relating to our lands. And I think this is one of the things that's really actually most promising about our indigenous movements is that we're, as Jim said, you know, speaking for the land, but we also have developed in our cultures balanced ways of living on and relating to these precious places. And so if other people can begin to learn from those cultures, those economies, then we can, I think, begin to turn things around.
All right. And, you know, I got another caller on the line who wants to know more. And looks like we got 3 books left. And when we take this caller, we'll have 2 books left. It is our October Book of the Month. You can also join us. And if this sounds like an interesting book to you, call in, find out more about it. And, you know, what are you wondering when it comes to, you know, Native nations connecting to your own Native nation? Call us right now, 1-800-996-2848. Let's go ahead and bring in Lena. She is in Isleta Pueblo, tuned in on KUNM here in New Mexico. Welcome to Native America Calling, Lena.
Good morning to you. I have a question regarding the Hawaiians, our brothers and sisters to the south of us. Do they have, like we do in New Mexico, in the Pueblos in New Mexico, we have tribal governors, tribal councils, other tribes have tribal chairmen, executive boards. How do they get governed? Do they have a president, a governor? What do they have? I'm curious. And then, number two, I want to commend them from here to high heavens for their immersion school, their school where I heard last week that they speak the language. Everybody speaks the language. I loved hearing that. I loved hearing them, and I want to commend them for that. That's it.
All right, Lena, great to hear from you. Noelani, go ahead. You can respond to our caller, Lena.
Okay, thank you, Lena, for that. Our immersion schools is our language revitalization movement is one of the things that's covered in the book by Hawaiian language educator Kapa Olivera. As far as the governance question, we have, because of the beginning of the U.S. occupation back in the 1890s, our native government was, marginalized, and we no longer have governing structures in place that are ours. There are bureaucratic offices within the state government that are meant to service Native Hawaiians, but we don't have a governing apparatus anymore. One of the things that I think is really exciting about some of the articles in the book is that they talk about the ways that people were setting up their own councils. So, for example, there's an article about Makua Valley that's written by Kalama Okaina Niheu, and she talks about how people who had been pushed off of various lands had ended up at Makua Valley, were fighting both for the ability to remain on the beach, living there because they didn't have any other homes, and were also fighting the U.S. military bombing of the mountain side of that valley. They formed a council, Makua Council, of residents who were there. And similarly, in many other chapters in the book, you see how when a struggle was taking place, that councils would be formed. These councils, for the most part, were temporary. They weren't ongoing, sort of in terms of their longevity. They really were formed out of the need for people to be able to make decisions together. But I think it really speaks to the fact that we can govern ourselves if we're given the opportunity to do that. And we see that, coming up in various communities. So that's how I would answer that question.
All right. And you know, there's a lot in here. I think just taking a look at some of the personal profiles that are in here, you were calling them portraits earlier, and just hearing directly from people and their thoughts about how, their nations are forming or have been challenged. You start hearing some of the history that the two of you have been sharing with us. And I think when you hear from first person and how it goes into practice, it seems to go a little deeper into our understanding, and I really appreciate hearing some of those first-person voices in the book. And Ikaika, there is also another contributor in the book. I want to talk about the photos. There is a lot of action in the images we're seeing, and one gentleman, it plays a big role in a lot of the photos in the book. I'm talking about Ed Grievey, and he's actually on the line with us today. Ikaika, before we bring him in, anything you want to share about how important Ed's photos are to just understanding, movements in Native Hawaii?
Sure. I could say that Ed has been sort of immersed within our community for the last 40 years, and his photos are probably the best documentation of our grassroots struggles, land struggles, struggles for sovereignty, all those things. He's really done an amazing job of documenting and telling the story of the people. And he got started as a photojournalist and soon became deeply, deeply part of the community that is engaging directly in these efforts.
All right, let's go ahead and bring in Ed. Hello, joining us from Honolulu, Hawaii. Ed Grievey, welcome to our hour. And we're talking about the book and the photos, that you are connecting many eyes to Native nations. Ed, what has it meant to you to be alongside and, being there as witness to some of these huge social movements in Native Hawaii? Go ahead, Ed.
Well, I'm originally from California. I've been here over 40 years, and I guess the main broad lesson that I've learned by observing and photographing these kind of movements is that indigenous cultures and Western cultures have a very different view of land. And Western cultures view land as a commodity, whereas indigenous cultures do not. They see it as a sustaining force. If you take care of it, it will take care of you. And in this time that we're in right now with a developing scarcity of raw materials, that viewpoint, I feel, needs to be absorbed by the larger community of the United States, because just exploiting land for profit is no longer going to be sustainable. And I would, overall, that's the main lesson that I have learned. I believe Hawaiian culture has other things to teach Westerners, but that's the main lesson that I see needs to be spread among the larger nation.
And Ed, when it comes to the photos that are in the book, anything specific you want to let our listeners know about today? You know, about the photos.
Well, I started out actually. I was a surfer adventurer, came to Hawaii in the early '60s, and sort of by accident, a friend of mine was a surfing magazine editor in the late '60s. Asked me to look into a organization called Save Our Surf because they were resisting efforts to destroy surf sites. And I started photographing that since I was a freelance commercial photographer at the time. And that led to resistance to evictions that were occurring in the '70s and all over Hawaii. And it was just very interesting to me to see people rise up against very powerful economic and political forces to have their voices heard.
Well, Ed, I do also want to applaud you, too, for you know, being there on the scene and bringing those moments to us. I mean, it's one thing to learn about it, but also when you have images that really take you there, you learn a lot. And Ed, great to hear from you there in Honolulu. I got another caller we're going to go to. Let's bring in Patty in Spokane, Washington, tuned in on KSFC. Patty, what would you like to add?
I really want to commend you for just great programming. I'm really interested in reading the book, but you bring in the perspective of the Hawaiians. You had a while ago, you had Maoris from New Zealand. You had, I think it was an interview in Ecuador. I just think it's fascinating that you bring in all these different diverse groups that need their voices heard. I'm not Native, and I really go to you to be able to hear a totally different perspective. So keep up the good work. It's just wonderful.
Thanks, Patty. It's great to hear that. We appreciate your call there in Spokane, and we're going to continue bringing you more voices from many different Native nations. Let's go ahead and bring one more caller in. We're going to squeeze in Steve in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. Steve, go ahead. You can join us on air. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've lived the majority of my life in northwest Minnesota next to the White Earth Reservation, and I've always felt somewhat of a connection to the Native American people, but it's just within the last year as I've aged and matured that I've begun to take more of an interest in their history, and I've read two books. One was of the culture of the Montana Native Americans from the late 1800s, early 1900s, and then the life and history of Black Elk from South Dakota. And so the Polynesian history would be meaningful to me as well. But I think now that I'm appreciate nature and the land even more that I've read some history of the Native American people.
Well, Steve, you got some more good reading ahead. Thanks for your call there in Detroit Lakes. And we are getting close to the end of the hour. Ikaika, there is so much more to talk about when we talk about what this book brings us to. You know, what would you like to leave us with today, you know, as we learn more?
I would love for folks to read the book and to maybe learn a bit from how we've approached social change in Hawaii and we would love to hear from other folks about how they've been able to fight for more rights and for justice and for their lands. And hopefully we can all advance our struggles together.
All right. And where do people find your publication?
Well, you know, hopefully it'll be available at bookstores, but if there are any bookstores left, but you can buy it from Duke directly, or you can also buy it on Amazon.
Okay, great. And Noilani, we got about a minute left. Anything you want to leave us with?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the lessons for me of these movements and their connections to movements in Native America is the importance of indigenous forms of government. There are always going to be efforts by the settler state to contain our sovereignty within what they see as, you know, proper forms of government, how you make decisions, how you organize yourselves, how you relate to land. But it's really by relying on our own forms that were developed in balance with all of the relations around us, you know, our natural environment and all the beings in our natural environment that allow for a balanced living. So we need to have faith in our indigenous forms of government and to strengthen them and to strengthen our communities at the ground level.
All right. And Noilani, if you can just give me five names that are in the book so people know what's ahead.
Five names of individuals that are in the book?
Yep, go ahead.
There's an excellent portrait. It's actually a self-portrait by Puhi Pau, who is also a filmmaker, part of the dynamic duo called Namaka Oka Aina. You can see, in addition to what we've documented through text and Ed's photos, they've documented through video. So Namaka Oka Aina has some wonderful videos that document many of the struggles here, and Puhi Pau tells his story of how he got politicized in the book. We also have the struggle of Mauna Awa Kea, as I mentioned, that's ongoing and that continues. The struggle against biocolonialism, genetic modification, that's told by Le'a Kanehe, and that features people like Walter Riddy, who have been
And many, many more. We're at the end of the hour. Noilani, great to talk with you. And thanks to everybody for joining us here on Native America Calling. We'll be back again tomorrow with more from our electronic talking circle. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Buju, gikamamui minuayam in gishbin gunawain dagwasian. Maji dangi gwenenegim gushka denogizisung medaswe ashinano gunagazid. Nandagi kain dan gishbin da debain dagwasian. Mawadishuin, www.healthcare.gov/tribal, Gamaganoj 1-800-318-2596, Jidaji Kaman, Gaundinagadig, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Miigwech.
Our democracy is a government of the people, for the people. Let's keep it that way. Vote on November 4th. Get registered, cast your vote. It's that simple. More information at nativenews.net. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.